Welcome to the University of California San Francisco Sports Medicine Podcast featuring Dr. Nirav Pandya, Dr. Brian Feely, and Dr. Drew Lansdown discussing hot topics in sports medicine and society. We hope you enjoy our podcast and look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome, everyone, to the seventh edition of our podcast, 6 to 8 weeks through UCSF Perspectives in Sports Medicine. Once again, we have myself, Dr. Nirav Pandya, Dr. Brian Feely, and Dr. Drew Lansdown. Today, we're going to be talking about a pathology that we see very commonly here in the Bay Area, particularly when there is a ski season taking place, shoulder instability. A lot of times we'll hear things on news reports, such as a player may have separated a shoulder, they've dislocated their shoulder, they have a rotator cuff injury, and it can be very difficult to differentiate out what actually may be going on with the shoulder. When someone's shoulder does dislocate, it is very acute and can have a very typical presentation. So my first question for you, Brian, when someone comes in saying they've had a shoulder dislocation, how do you confirm that diagnosis and what questions do you want to ask the patient when they're in the clinic?
Yeah, sure. So I think backing up, I think as those of us that cover team sports, a shoulder dislocation happens pretty rarely. But when it does happen on the field, for most of us, it's pretty obvious. And I think we've seen some football players and other competitive sport athletes. I had a basketball player when we were covering a game once where they dislocate their shoulder. And it's pretty obvious. And there's an old famous picture of Dwayne Wade holding his arm down. And that's usually what happens when people dislocate their arm. Their shoulder comes forward and out of the socket. And in order to make them feel better, because they acutely obviously feel pretty bad, we essentially just manipulate it back into place. And when that happens, it ends up that they feel pretty good, especially the high school students that we cover. I've had a few times where we'll put the shoulder back in, and then all of a sudden, they're like, well, can I go back in and play? We're like, well, no, not yet. We've got to get this more fully evaluated, and it'll come right back out. But when they come into clinic, the things that I really want to know are based on what sport they play, how many times has this happened to them before? Because the way we manage first-time dislocators is both inherently interesting and also controversial, but really depends, honestly, on the type of athlete and how good they are sometimes. And then I really want to know early on what their goals are, if they're a single-sport athlete or if they're a multi-sport athlete, because if we're managing them in season versus out of the season, it's going to be different, and I want to start thinking about what timing we need to get them back into.
Drew, a question for you. I mean, for our audience, what are some of the structures that actually keep the shoulder in place? I mean, it seems like a joint that has a lot of mobility, but it takes a lot of force to get it out. So what are some of the structures on the shoulder that help to keep it in place that can potentially prevent a dislocation?
Yeah, so the shoulder, it has the greatest range of motion of any joint in the body. And that lets us throw and spike a volleyball, swim, like do these overhead activities, which are great. But then that also puts it at risk for more injury, and then also requires a number of structures to keep it stable. So one structure is the labrum, and it's kind of like a gasket seal around the shoulder socket, and that lines the joint and then provides a little bumper to keep the ball centered on the socket. So when people dislocate the shoulder, they typically tear the labrum. And then that keeps the shoulder unstable afterwards. There's also a joint capsule that lines the joint and then provides some stability too. And then a number of ligaments that are kind of thickening of that capsule, but they help support the joint and keep it in place. And then another big one is the rotator cuff. And that's a group of four muscles and tendons that surround the shoulder. And they really help to keep the ball centered on the socket. So the shoulder really needs all of those structures to perform everything it can do. And then whenever it dislocates, we'll often have an injury in at least one of those areas.
Hey Brian, how is this different from a shoulder separation? I mean, we hear that a lot, particularly with the NFL season. When someone suffers a shoulder separation, what's the differentiation between a separation and a dislocation?
I think that's a great question. And early on, I hate to admit it, but I think it took me a few years in orthopedics before I figured out the difference. And it becomes critically important in fantasy football. A shoulder separation is when your clavicle becomes separated and moves up. So a good example is the year that the Giants first beat the Patriots in the Super Bowl. Around week 6 or 7, both Eli Manning and Alex Smith suffered shoulder separations. There's different grades to shoulder separations depending on how far up your clavicle moves. Probably based on the quality of the remainder of the season, Alex Smith's was considerably more severe because he essentially ended up having season-ending surgery, whereas Eli came back through the miracle pass and brought the Giants to a Super Bowl win over the Patriots, who were 18-0 at that time. I still have an 18-1 t-shirt someplace in my closet, and I would wear it proudly if I weren't still afraid of Bill Belichick hurting random people. A shoulder dislocation happens lower, and you're often out for a considerably more amount of time. Nirav, when you have a, let's say, a high school athlete, which you treat a lot of, what are your considerations on when somebody with a shoulder dislocation can go back in, and how long do you think it should take before these athletes can get back in?
That's a great question. I think it's pretty controversial. I mean, if you look at some of the literature, there's some studies that talk about, you know, the average return to play being 10 to 14 days, which I think is way too low. Typically what I like to do is when these athletes come in, number one, I have to get a sense of how high energy the mechanism was. Number two, they have to have their full mobility. They have to have their full strength. And then most importantly, where I think a lot of athletes will get caught up in is they have to be able to do whatever sport they're doing. So they may come on and say, look, I feel great. And then I'm like, okay, well, you know, can you shoot a basketball? Can you get in your stance as alignment? And they can't do that. And I think that's where the longer period of time for the rehab comes in. So I think on average for the collision athletes, sometimes it takes up to 4 to 6 weeks for them to get back. For some of the non-collision athletes, sometimes it can be 2 to 3 weeks. But I think the big thing for me is, number one, if they've ever had any kind of instability before, and number two, you know, how much force it took to get out. So it's a very individualized discussion, but I think the worst thing you can do is go back too quickly, because a lot of times these kids will get reduced on the field. They may not go see someone, they feel great, and then they have another dislocation 3 weeks later and another dislocation 6 weeks later, and then they finally come into our clinic. And that's where I think there's a lot of problems in terms of how we manage their treatment.
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit more aggressive, but usually for my football players, I'll put them back in a brace and try to get them back around 2 to 3 weeks. I think if you're lucky with the teams that you're covering, the coaches play a big part in this, because a coach can see, okay, if this athlete isn't really performing at their level and they may be at a safety risk, not only for themselves, but their teammates around them, they're often pretty good, at least for the schools that I cover, at holding those kids out. What do you think, Drew?
I think that 2 to 3 week range is usually pretty typical for a lot of kids. And I'll even talk to them in clinic and just say, like Nirav was saying, that they can't do what they need to for their position, that, you know, they're not going to be able to perform well. They're not going to have fun out there. And then also, you know, they may take an injury that they just need another week to 2 weeks to really get back. And turn it into something that ends their season, or you know, even delays the start of the next one. So I think usually you can kind of reason in that regard. But as long as they've got their full motion, full strength, and then you know, kind of feel confident in returning and being able to do what they need for their position, at least after that first dislocation, I think we can sometimes try to get them back to play. Brian, when do you talk to kids about? Or any patient about stabilizing their shoulders surgically after the first time they've dislocated it?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think for first time dislocators, initially, and since I'm older than you all, I remember when the mantra was, no matter what, a first time dislocator is treated non-operatively.
And we know that, Brian, when they didn't have MRIs, Brian, right? There was not the MRI machine.
They weren't doing surgery then.
Yeah.
Back in the 1930s when I started. No, you guys are both not that much younger. So when I was in training, we treated everybody with a first-time dislocator as somebody who would be treated non-operatively. We would put them in a sling for 6 weeks, and then we would get them back to doing the things that they wanted to do without surgery. Back then, surgery was usually an open procedure, so it involved about a 3-inch incision on the front of the shoulder, and it involved essentially putting the labrum back where it belonged. As I transitioned through fellowship and then into my own practice, especially over the last 10 years, almost all these surgeries, especially for early dislocators, meaning they've dislocated only a few times, are done arthroscopically. So I think the pendulum has shifted to where we will consider doing an arthroscopic surgery on these kids or young athletes for their first time dislocation. For me, it really depends on how unstable they are, whether or not they're able to return to sports, and whether or not they have another season coming up. So I think a good example in the Bay Area is we have a lot of young skiers who have their first time dislocating, especially towards the end of the season, and they really want to ski the following year. They've already bought their season pass to Squaw. And I think in those cases, it may be reasonable to consider fixing their shoulder after a first time dislocation. And the reason is that every time you have a dislocation, you're beating up your shoulder a little bit more. If you start beating up the shoulder to the point where you can't do your activities and you start losing a little bit of bone, it may change the outcome of that of the surgery, and it may mean that you need a bigger surgery.
You know, one of the things, Brian, I think I get concerned about, particularly with the young population, is that, you know, a lot of them dislocate out because they've been doing something, you know, very high energy. You know, they're skiing, they're playing football. And the thing that I struggle with is telling these kids that even though we fix your shoulder, if you go back to playing football or going back to skiing, there's always a chance you can dislocate out. What do you tell patients and families about the failure rates? Because no matter how good a surgical procedure is, they're still going to go back to their activities.
You mean with me or with everybody else?
We know about your failure rates. Maybe I should ask that question to Drew, because Drew revises your surgeries.
Well, I'll answer first. I'll let Drew answer too. I think it's really important to tell kids that play high-risk sports, especially things like wrestling or other contact and collision sports. There are some sports where somebody is actually trying to dislocate your shoulder. If you get your arm in a bad position while you're tackling, your arm is already in an at-risk position if your arm is kind of out to the side and then rotating up. So I tell my athletes or skiers or people that are going to be in unpredictable movements that even in the best of scenarios, your risk of redislocation at best is only going to go down to about 10%. And in a perfect world, we can get it down to 1% to 2%, but that usually involves people like basketball players, soccer players, or people that really don't do their activity all that often. And, you know, I remember when I was a fellow way back when, I think Drew was in middle school at that point, the person who I thought was the absolute best at doing shoulder stabilizations, he did it arthroscopically, the surgeries were beautiful, and it looked like a perfect reconstruction every single time, but he dealt mainly with high school lacrosse players who not only put their arm in an at-risk position, but then add a fulcrum to it. And his redislocation rate was almost 25%. And that's not because he wasn't a good surgeon. It's because the kids that he took care of were at such high risk for recurrence.
Yeah, we looked at Drew, go ahead.
But I think, you know, the main thing for patients to keep in mind too is that whenever we stabilize the shoulder, it's not making it any stronger than it was initially. It's just trying to bring back that support to keep it stable. But so if you're going back into those at-risk positions, or if somebody's cranking on the arm in wrestling, that you are still at risk, just like the other shoulders at risk for dislocating.
Yeah, and we looked at our series to piggyback on Brian's point about the young athletes. We looked at our series here of the patients under 18, and it was published in OJSM, and we found a redislocation rate about 25-30%, which is pretty, if you talk to most people who kind of do pediatric and adolescent sports, is kind of the failure rate, which seems pretty high. But once again, I think with a lot of these kids, it's a hard decision. And I'll ask Brian this question, like, at what point, you know, do you say, look, we're going to try an arthroscopic procedure with the understanding that it's kind of pushing the limit and maybe they should get an open procedure such as a coracoid transfer and open stabilization? It seems like you're balancing doing something really big and maybe they're going to get super stiff versus trying something arthroscopically that has a failure rate. How do you balance, maybe you and Drew as well too, balance that decision to maybe do a bigger procedure as the first procedure for these kids?
Okay, well, I think my, I would say, maybe poorly defined confidence in this would push me towards doing arthroscopically a little bit more than other people. I think also that's because people who have trained recently are much better at these open bone block transfers than I am. I think that for me, if you've lost more than 20% of bone, then and you are a contact or collision athlete, I'm going to be more likely to consider something open. But I think it's important for these patients to understand, even though it's a bigger procedure, the return to play rate, especially at about a year, is about the same no matter what surgery you have, if you had the right surgery. So if you've dislocated a few times, your labrum looks intact, looks present on MRI, you don't have considerable bone loss, an arthroscopic stabilization will get you back about 75-80% of the time, which is pretty good when you include that some kids are just going to stop playing that sport, or they were seniors and this is their surgery on their way to going to college and playing different sports or playing club sports. For the open procedures, it's a bigger surgery for sure, but the return to play rate is about the same. And they will, even though they'll have a scar, they should feel just about as stable. So I think it's important to consider the right surgery for the right person. Again, in my hands, I'm going to be a little bit more aggressive about the arthroscopic stabilization just because I'm more confident in my ability to do that surgery.
How about you, Drew? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things I always think about is just that you're doing the surgery and then the patient's going through like 6 to 9 months of rehab, taking time away from their sports and activities, and then, you know, looking to get back at that point. And so in kind of balancing it, just want to always make sure that we get to that end point with, you know, a great chance that they will have a stable shoulder, that we've chosen the right procedure. So I think even if it is a bigger procedure, sometimes it's worth doing that just to make sure that you get to that end point with a, you know, a good result, stable shoulder, and able to resume rather than going back, redislocating or not being confident with the shoulder, and then taking the next year off also and kind of, you know, prolonging the recovery time frame.
Okay. So Nirav, in an earlier podcast, we talked about all the criteria we use for ACL return to sports. It's kind of interesting because shoulder instability, while it doesn't happen nearly as often, is still a surgery that we perform over 155,000 times a year in the United States. How come we don't have the same return to sport criteria for shoulder instability? And what do you use?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, when we look at, you know, lower extremity injuries, I think there's a lot of dynamic movement and kind of functional testing we can use because we know what a lot of lower extremity movements are going to be because we've studied it very well. I think with the upper extremity, because there's such a difference in how people move or kind of their kind of dynamic movement about the shoulder, it's a little bit harder to get a sense of what they're going to do. So what I typically do, I look at the, unlike the ACL, which is kind of like a ligamentous reconstruction, we're talking about labrum. I think the initial thing for me is when does soft tissue healing occur? And if we're thinking about soft tissue healing, we know that that has occurred in about 3 months, you know, more or less. And I know Brian could probably talk a little bit more being the basic science researcher about that. But, and then after that, it's a lot of based on their strength and function. And if they're able to meet the strength of the other side. So for me, that ends up being somewhere, you know, between 4 to 6 months, but it can vary a lot based on their sport. But I do agree that we're still kind of at the cusp of figuring out when these athletes can return to play because we just don't have that multitude of data that has been there for, you know, lower extremity injuries. A question for you, Drew. How do you, I think the best thing, we talk about surgery, we talk about prevent, you know, talk about how to rehab, but how do we prevent this from happening in the first place? I think that's a key component that we can hopefully prevent people from, you know, getting surgery in our hands.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's tough with the shoulder, but obvious things like not falling. You know, a lot of the ski injuries, it's, you know, wiping out and landing on the shoulder in that position of instability where the arm's up to the side and rotate it out. And then same thing with, you know, football. It's hard to prevent a lot of those collisions. Just you can't really always control the arm in that position. But yeah, I think probably the best things are just maintaining good rotator cuff strength around the shoulder, good motion, and then just kind of protecting yourself when you do fall to not have your arm out to the side. That would be the only things that could really help avoid it.
Yeah, I think Drew brings up the point that playing sports is inherently somewhat risky. As soon as we tell somebody to tuck their shoulder, and I totally agree as somebody who prefers shoulders to all other parts of the body, we should protect our shoulders at all costs. So I tell my athletes, just tuck your shoulder, hit your head, you'll be totally fine and you won't remember anything.
That's good advice, Brian. Well, hopefully the goal is that no one ends up like Drew Brees and has their shoulder completely out and needs a huge reconstruction. But I think it's important for athletes to know that if you do dislocate your shoulder, much like Drew Brees returned to, you know, that high level after a major dislocation, you can get back in the right hands with the right rehab process. But if we can prevent the injury, that's key. So once again, thanks again, Brian and Drew. I think this is a great conversation for our audience about shoulder instability, something that we're going to see more and more as people become increasingly active. And we look forward to having you listen to our podcast at the next go around. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the University of California, San Francisco Sports Medicine Podcast featuring Dr. Mira Bundia, Dr. Brian Feely, and Dr. Drew Lansbaum. We look forward to hearing your feedback and hope you look forward to our next episode. Thank you.